76. Right now, wind northeast at 13, 48 degrees Kenosha, 47 for Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Thursday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. This weekend is going to be an exciting one for music, particularly because of the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra rounding out its current season with what promises to be an exciting night of music with works of Rossini and Mendelssohn and Franz Joseph Haydn. And I'm excited to be joined in this portion of the morning show by, first of all, the man who will be wielding the baton Saturday evening, Maestro Robert Hasty, the artistic director of the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra. And we also have on hand the special guest soloist for a Saturday evening's concert, cellist Alexander Hirsch. He will be playing the Haydn Cello Concerto in C major. And a little bit later in the hour, we're going to be talking about the new fund supported under the auspices of the Kenosha Community Foundation, which is helping to benefit the Kenosha Symphony as it moves forward. So we'll be hearing from a board member in just a little bit. But first, we begin with musical matters. And Robert Hasty and Alexander Hirsch, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Good to have you both here. Maestro Hasty, let's begin with you and hear a little bit about the putting together of this concert, not so much taking all of the individual pieces individually quite yet, but just in general, what inspired you to want to put together this particular program?
Well, thank you for asking. As always, whenever I invite a soloist, I usually like to program around that soloist. Alex and I got to work together a couple of years ago with another orchestra, and we hit it off very, very well, and I thought we had a wonderful musical connection. So the way that it went around is, so as soon as the board approved for me to invite a soloist, I contacted Alex, and I just said, okay, what you got? What do you have? And he gave me some, it's really great when soloists can give you a variety of choices. He threw out the Sassan, he threw out Shostakovich, but Haydn just seemed to really work with this program. And because Haydn is considered to be it's 18th century, so what we would call today as a chamber orchestra repertoire is a little bit smaller. I can program around that. And even though Haydn isn't particularly Italian, he's definitely not Italian, we would not consider this, but there's a lot of Italian influence that we can go into later that we're talking about Haydn. And I thought it would be a wonderful opportunity to program around Italian-themed pieces. Now, there's only one Italian composer, as I believe you mentioned, you talked about Gioacchino Rossini. Ironically, with a concert of Italian-themed music, there's only one Italian composer, and that would be the Italian in Algiers, the Overture by Rossini. And then we will do the Haydn with Alex. But the centerpiece of the program after intermission will be the Italian Symphony. Again, not by an Italian composer, but by one of our most important composers in the repertoire, which is Felix Mendelssohn. This completely rounds out this, what I think is a nice central theme of Italian influence in classical music. And all of these are favorites in the classical music world.
Lots of beautiful things to enjoy in this concert, and I know a lot of people are really excited. And, of course, it is really wonderful to have a stellar guest soloist like Alexander Hirsch. Before we hear from him directly, Maestro, tell us a little more about your first meeting with Alexander Hirsch and that initial collaboration that you found so satisfying and fun.
Well, we a couple of years ago in Highland Park, we did an American, all American composers, and I believe it was the first time we had performed that concerto, right, Alex? What was the concerto that we did?
It was a Victor Herbert Cello Concerto Number 2.
Victor Herbert Concerto Number 2, and for both of us, it was our first time. And if you go on YouTube, you're going to find some really nice moments that we had during that particular concerto. So when we worked together on the Herbert, which, and it's gorgeous. The slow movement is one of the most beautifully expressive moments that you can experience in music. And I would say Herbert is very underperformed, and you're not going to find very many performances of that particular concerto. But after that connection that Alex and I had, I really felt like this is a guy who I want to work with again, and maybe on a piece that I have much more experience with, and I believe Alex probably has much more experience with, which the Haydn certainly fits in that category. But the audiences are going to find in Alex a beautifully expressive lyrical tone quality. So for instance, when we get to that second movement of the Haydn, you're going to hear that which I believe is influenced by the Italian operatic style. You're going to hear this beautiful flowing melody, and I just can't wait to hear Alex play that second movement, because it certainly falls into that category that really enticed me into being a fan of Alex's playing.
Well, I want to second the motion about how beautiful that Victor Herbert work is, and the performance that I've watched on YouTube of that slow movement. It is absolutely sublime. So Robert Hasty with the Highland Park Strings, I believe, and Alexander Hirsch, the soloist. That's an absolutely gorgeous performance of a work that does not get to perform all that often. So it was a real treat to experience that. So Alexander Hirsch, it's so great to be connecting with you today. You're certainly an exciting young talent, an award-winning young cellist. You have a shelf full of trophies from all kinds of different competitions that you have won. You have played in concerts and recitals all across the country, including the stage of Carnegie Hall itself. Tell us a little bit about your earliest years being raised in good old Chicago, Illinois. Tell us about especially your musical life in Chicago, and at what point cello became a really important part of your life.
Yeah, I'm the fourth generation professional string player in my family. I'm an only child, so I sort of felt the desire to continue on from a very young age. I'm pretty sure my mom wanted me to be a lawyer, and I let her down, but that's okay. We're in therapy. We're working on it. So music was sort of the central part of the value system for me from as early as I can remember. I began playing the cello at 5, and I even remember before then just knowing my top choice was I wanted to be a professional musician when I grew up. And apparently in kindergarten, I would even tell the teachers, yeah, I'm probably going to be a musician when I grow up. If not, that'll be a lawyer. And if not, that'll be an actor. And so far, the first one's worked out. So we'll see.
I'm curious, and I've asked this of other musicians when they start very, very young. Has it been an uninterrupted love affair, that is you and the cello? Or were there ever any periods in your life, in childhood or adulthood, when for whatever reason there were other things that threatened to sort of crowd the cello off of the central place in your life? Or by and large, has it been a very steady, unendingly positive relationship, you and the cello?
It's curious. I actually initially wanted to play the double bass. I was this runt of a little kid, and for some reason, I was just attracted to this double bass, and My parents had to break it to me. They don't make those your size, so you better start with cello. Well, it turns out they didn't even make cellos my size. So I actually started with a big viola with the pin on the end of it, and I would sit on phone books. I know the current young generation has no clue even what a phone book is, but this was my chair back in the day. And it, since, I thankfully I never switched to double bass, but honestly, since age five, it's kind of been a linear sort of love affair. I didn't get serious about the cello in terms of practicing until quite a bit later. I remember going to this music camp called Meadowmount in upstate New York, and that I was 14 years old, and that was really an aha moment for me, because I was surrounded by all these kids who were my age but were so much better than me, and I was just really inspired and sort of took things into high gear and started practicing more. And it's a challenging life as a musician, but the love for music doesn't ever seem to fade.
Tell us about the experience you had at New England Conservatory of Music, where I believe you received your undergraduate degree and then also did graduate work as well. What was best about studying there?
Yeah, I had a fantastic experience overall in Boston and at New England Conservatory. It's a very special environment when you're surrounded by so many curious and great young musicians. I was really drawn to the fact that chamber music was a huge part of the culture there, and I just wanted to be a part of it. I had wonderful chamber music experiences. I had many serious string quartets and stuff like that. And I really believe that, like, no matter what, it sort of all boils down to chamber music. Like, even if one's playing as soloist with an orchestra, that's just large scale chamber music. We're still always communicating in that same way, in that same team sport kind of way.
I love that. I want to be sure to take a moment to talk about what people can find if they search out your YouTube channel, because there is an array of wonderful videos there that you have created, many of them involving chamber music, and many of them having sort of the appearance of what we think of as music videos, with really interesting images to the accompaniment of whatever piece of chamber music you happen to be playing. And they are so artfully put together. I mean, absolutely just riveting. I'm very, very impressed. Tell us a little bit about what got you interested in doing this and to what extent you are responsible not only for the music we hear played, but also the images we are seeing on the screen.
Yeah, that's like one of my deep passions is making short films with my friends. And I had this realization actually during the pandemic that so often in classical music, it's just a static shot video of someone performing wearing all black a piece of music. And we've sort of accepted this as convention. And I sort of started asking myself, well, what if one combined narrative, like a story with a beginning, a middle, and an end, and set that to classical music? And out of that, since we're sort of all moving into this digital age, whether we like it or not, if there's some way that this can reach a new audience with classical music, and it's felt very untapped to me, it's not oversaturated, and I've always liked sort of coming up with stories and just sort of this intersection of all different kinds of art forms. So with those films that are on my YouTube channel, I usually write them together with one friend or two friends. We shoot them with my friend Mike Rattani, who's a former cellist turned filmmaker. And it's either just he and I, or he, I, and one other person. It's a total skeleton crew. We come up with a shot list. We put the story together. I record the audio usually separately, There's a separate team that does that, but this is one of my obsessions, and it's something I really believe in, just for the future of classical music.
Hmm. I really love them, and I want to mention that I've never been a huge fan of music videos, because one of the things I really dislike a lot is lip syncing. And of course, so many music videos are of singers, mostly pop singers, of course, moving their lips and pretending they're singing, when in fact they're just moving their lips to something that was recorded long ago. And so I've just never been able to get past that. And so I've always found, in at least in general, music videos to be just kind of irritating and kind of dumb looking, frankly. And of course, there are exceptions. And of course, your music videos are entirely different, and they are like short films with a soundtrack, and they work just wonderfully well. Do you see this potentially going in other directions? I mean, could you see yourself further exploring this kind of artistic endeavor even beyond these short films that you are creating, or does this feel like what you are meant to do in this respect?
Yeah, well, thank you so much for the kind words about it. I see there's a lot of untapped stuff I'd love to explore in that world. I have a bunch of bigger projects I'm working on. I move painfully slow with everything that's like a film project. It just takes forever for me to sort of make sure it's right and it's well thought out. But I definitely have more along that I'd want to explore. I also have this realization too that, for example, I made a video that's called A Study in Pasta Making, and it's set to a Popper cello etude. And one of the reasons I made it is because I thought it was funny. But second, if I had just put up a video of me playing a Popper etude, it probably reach some people, but probably a small audience. Like, you got to be a real cello nerd like me to be seeking out Popper etude videos on YouTube. But I realized, I was like, what if I set it to a story and I didn't even show me playing cello? It's literally this comedy of errors of me making pasta from scratch. And I just really thought that there's more to reach there. And that sort of set off another chain of thought of like, how far can we take this? And what does that boundary look like? I'd love to make a feature film. And that definitely is a goal. But at the end of the day, I'm a cellist at heart, and I love performing live. There's nothing like the communion of live music and sharing in that space just all together with the audience, the musicians on stage, no phones out, just total attention to what's in front of us. I know it's an analog experience, but it's so special to me. And so the film stuff it's definitely something I love in addition to the performing. And I also like composing and all sorts of other weird stuff.
I want to give you a quick chance to talk about Nexus Chamber Music, which is something that you are co-artistic director. And this is speaks to your great interest in and love for chamber music. And the two-week festival that Nexus Chamber Music shares with the city of Chicago every year is something that I know a lot of people look forward to. Explain to our listeners who aren't familiar with it what this is all about.
Yeah, Nexus Chamber Music is it's a collective. We put on a festival each year, mostly in downtown Chicago. We're based at a venue called Guarneri Hall, and it's a tiny venue. It's a 60-seat recording studio, but by design, because we really want to break down the barriers between audience and performers. So there's no stage. It's a tiny, intimate space, but I sort of equate it to like eating at the chef's table or something like that in a restaurant. You get just so up close and personal, and it's something I started it with my best friend 8 years ago, which is crazy to think about considering I look 11 years old and certainly not old enough to have anything that's 8 years old to my name. But we've been doing it for 8 years. We've performed at the Ravinia Festival, We've been in residence at Oberlin College. We do a residency at Missouri State University every year. And this year, too, we'll be playing up at Winnetka Congregational Church, which is an amazing venue in Winnetka, Illinois, just north of Chicago. So it's something we're really passionate about. We commission, we make a lot of high production value music videos, again, tied to my own love for that sort of world. But Nexus is a, it's like a playground and a laboratory for my friends and I each year.
Nicely put. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking in this portion of today's morning show with Alexander Hirsch, who is the guest soloist with the Kenosha Symphony, Saturday evening, 7:30 p.m. He will be playing the Haydn Cello Concerto in C major. Also on the program, the Overture to l'Italiana in Algeri, the Italian Girl in Algiers, by Gioachino Rossini, and Mendelssohn's Symphony No. 4, known as the Italian Symphony, rounds out what promises to be a colorful and enjoyable evening. Maestro Hasty, it's easy to sometimes think about the overture that starts so many orchestra concerts as just sort of a trifle, not too much of a big deal, just something kind of fun to get things started with. But I suspect that something like this Rossini overture present plenty of challenges for the orchestra to put together in terms of finding that wonderful grace and delicacy and energy that is part and parcel to these great Rossini overtures.
Well, one of the things that's really hard for American orchestras to duplicate is the Italian articulation and Italian style. So for instance, I've been into to scene opera in Milan, and the I remember when I was hearing Cinderella performed there, and I was listening to the bow strokes, and I was listening to the articulation of another important opera in the repertoire, and I'm just going, well, how do I imitate that here in the United States? It's very, very challenging, and I think it's just part of the innate understanding of Italian musicians when they perform there. So that is something that's very challenging for me as a conductor and for orchestral musicians to be able to kind of duplicate that Italian style. Now, this particular one, as you mentioned, we have to remember that it's called the Italian Girl in Algiers, it's a comic opera. And so we have to get the humor involved in that's a lot different than a lot of other overtures. So that is the other thing, is to try to get that comic opera feel. And I think it kind of, unlike a lot of overtures which start really loud, this one starts really soft. So the audience is probably going to go, oh, wait, are they playing? It just starts with very, very soft pizzicato, and then finally gets into this frantically fast string passages where they have to get that sautier bow stroke to try to imitate that Italian style. And it's very playful and lively. And then it ends with a hysterically fast tempo. And so the goal is to start this concert with a lot of humor. And we have to remember that all three composers were pretty young on this composer. Rossini was only 21 when he composed and when he wrote the entire opera in 18 days. And so this opera, or this overture, certainly sets up the opera that is to come. And then audiences, it was his first major comic opera, and the audiences loved it.
Mm. It's a great, great opera. It's the first thing I saw at the Metropolitan Opera, one of the first, and I still cherish that memory, and the overture is an absolute masterpiece. What a great idea for starting this concert. Alexander Hirsch, what do you have to say about the Haydn Cello Concerto in C major that you will be playing with the symphony Saturday night?
I think it's sort of a perfect piece. It's just wonderfully classical. There's not a note out of place. It's also quite interesting that it wasn't discovered until the early 1960s, this piece. And I love, my grandpa tells me that when he was a kid, they just referred to the Haydn cello concerto, referring to the second Haydn cello concerto, the D major, which is what has been in circulation and part of the repertoire for much longer. It's wild to think that this piece is only 60-something years old in terms of public, you know, sort of acceptance. But it's an amazing work, and it's got everything you could ask for. It's got that sort of, as Maestro Hasty pointed out, that aria, that Italian beauty in the second movement. That's, it's so lyrical, even though it's not an Italian work, but it totally bears that operatic sort of influence, I think. And the outer movements have such style and panache. The third movement is just fleeting. It's quick, but it's always classy and just full of this amazing effervescence.
Mm. Fantastic.
Yeah, and I would like to chime in on that, that third movement. I feel the influence of Boccherini, another important Italian composer. And I also find it very interesting that a copy of this piece was found in the Prague National Museum in 1961, and that for years and years and years, nobody was familiar with this. And as a teacher at colleges and conservatories for the last 24 years, this is probably one of the concertos that almost every music major, cello major, learns and performs at recitals and as concertos. And it's also very famous for being one of Haydn's most important works. As you know, we have to understand that the idea of making money in the 18th century as a composer was pretty hit and miss. But Haydn was rare in the fact that he was constantly employed. And that gratitude of getting a regular paycheck working for Prince Nicholas Esterhazy, his orchestra, they had a cellist in that orchestra, and his name was Josef Franz Weigl, and he wrote it for him in that orchestra. So when you think about a composer who is living well, the joy of having that and having a lot of fans, including Beethoven and Mozart were big fans. I feel the joy is expressed through this concerto. Mm.
Nicely put. It's a wonderful, wonderful work, and I'm sure it will be a wonderful way to finish out the first half of this concert. And then, of course, it all finishes out with Mendelssohn's Symphony No. 4, affectionately known as his Italian Symphony. Does it bear that nickname for any really specific reason? I know his third is the Scottish and his fifth is the Reformation, and there's very clear reasons for them to be nicknamed that. What about the Italian Symphony?
Well, Mendelssohn traveled a lot. I mean, he, like the other composers, he wrote this when he was very young, but he was quite well traveled. So for instance, the Scottish, there were a couple of great pieces that he wrote after traveling to Scotland, and that was the obviously the Third Symphony, but also Fingal's Cave. The overture was a part of that. But this one was he composed this symphony during his tour of Italy from 1829 through 1831. He visited Florence, Venice, Naples, Rome, Milan. He visited all of these, and he wrote letters and expressed his joy and inspiration from Italy, describing the country as a source of supreme happiness. And so when you listen to this symphony, just like we talked about Haydn, you hear joy. When you listen to especially the last movement is based upon an Italian dance called a saltarello, and it is exactly what Italian music would sound like. So I think people would be surprised if they didn't know that this was written by Mendelssohn, that this was not written by an Italian composer. But in four movements, we have the Allegro Vivace, which reflects the sunny and cheerful spirit. The second movement is more like a procession, like a religious procession. The third movement is a minuet, typical minuet and trio that is defined as tradition in symphonic composition. But then that last movement, I think, defines it. He calls this the Italian symphony, and that's probably what makes it the most Italian. What's interesting is that he wasn't satisfied with this version at first, and he wrote another version when he was a little bit older. The first version he wrote when he was 24 years old, and he conducted it for the first time in London. And then he revised it in 1834, but guess what? We all prefer the first version. Pretty much that's the only version that, so we all, as conductors and musicians, we disagree with Mendelssohn. We prefer his first version, and we'll be doing that on Saturday. Mm.
It's one of the really great symphonies of its time, and I am excited at the opportunity to hear it played live, and of course, the whole program, Rossini and Haydn before it, promised to be wonderful treats as well. Alexander Hirsch, real quick, what's next for you once you're done with this performance with the Kenosha Symphony?
After this, I fly to California to actually play Brahms Double Concerto with the Palo Alto Chamber Orchestra and my father on violin. And this is special because this is the orchestra that my parents first met in and played together in when they were 14 and 16 years old. So it feels like a sort of a homecoming of sorts.
Ah, fantastic. Well, safe travels to you and best wishes to you. And we are excited about this upcoming performance in which you collaborate with the Kenosha Symphony and Maestro Robert Hasty. Thank you to both of you for being part of the morning show today. Best wishes to you and all of the musicians involved in Saturday night's concert.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Greg.
You're listening to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And before we leave the matter of Saturday night's Kenosha Symphony concert, I thought we would take a few minutes to reconnect with someone who was on the morning show recently, John Keel, who is a member of the board of directors. Often with these Kenosha Symphony interviews, we speak with Pete Rodriguez, who is president of the board and a member of the orchestra, but Pete happens to be out of town this week, and so we're instead speaking to John Keel because he was instrumental in the creation of a new fund to help support the Kenosha Symphony, a fund created under the auspices of the Kenosha Community Foundation, and a fund that is a stirring tribute to one of his relatives, Grace Kolakowski. And we're going to have him sort of restate the story of this fund and the difference that it's already making for the Kenosha Symphony. John Keel, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Greg, it's a pleasure to be with you again.
So as many of our listeners might remember, you joined me on the morning show a few weeks back along with Amy Grile, executive director of the Kenosha Community Foundation, to talk about this new fund that has just been created. I thought this would be a fitting moment to just sort of revisit that. Remind our listeners about who Grace Kolakowski was and the reason for creating this particular fund on behalf of the Kenosha Symphony.
Sure. Grace Kolakowski is my great aunt living here in Kenosha, and she has a lifetime legacy of supporting the arts and particularly the graphic arts. She is a watercolorist herself, and she's also very passionate about the performing arts. And so at her stage of life, she is very interested in leaving a legacy and hoping that with her help, the arts can continue to thrive even after she's passed on. And so she has created a fund at the Kenosha Community Foundation. The specific purpose is to put the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra on a very firm financial footing. So she donated $100,000 to start this fund. And so she met all of the initial startup requirements that the Kenosha Community Foundation requires to set up such a fund. And so that fund now is an asset of the Community Foundation, and so the principal stays with them, but any capital gains or interest that the fund generates will then be used every year to provide grant money for the Kenosha Symphony. And so the money is professionally managed. It's, I believe, 60% in equities and 40% in bonds, so a very conservative asset mix. And once a year, their board of directors votes on a percentage of the fund that can be distributed. And recently, it's been 5%. And so right now, as the fund sits, that fund will generate $5,000 each year for the symphony. But the great thing about this fund, Greg, is that it's not just for Grace, it's for the whole community. And now that Grace has kind of done the heavy lifting of getting this fund put in place, someone with even as small of a donation or a gift of $25 can go to the community foundation and say, I'd like to add to the fund with my donation. And so the fund is like leading the way in the vanguard of providing this support for the orchestra. So over time, as other people who share that same interest with my great aunt can add to the fund, and then their gift will live on and provide a legacy for the orchestra as well.
Fantastic. I should think that, for instance, when you are sitting in the audience, as I'm sure you will be Saturday night, listening to this next concert, which of course concludes the current season of the Kenosha Symphony, you're going to be sitting there listening to that beautiful music with a very special sense of pride and gratitude.
Absolutely, and knowing that this will continue on into the future. We have a terrific string and orchestra program in our local schools at Tremper, Indian Trail, at Bradford. And so we are trying to cultivate that next generation of classical music lovers to come to the symphony and to support these treasures of our Western civilization and keep this wonderful music alive, relevant, and entertaining for people. So yes, I will be very gratified sitting in that audience Saturday night.
John Keel, and the fund that has been created for the Kenosha Symphony Orchestra rests under the auspices of the Kenosha Community Foundation, and anyone listening who is interested in contributing to that fund is welcome to contact the Kenosha Community Foundation for more information. John Keel, a member of the Board of Directors of the Kenosha Symphony, thank you so much for your time. Best wishes to you.
Thank you so much, Greg, for this opportunity to promote the fund and the orchestra and your program. So thank you so much.
You're listening to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And in this portion of WGTD's Morning Show, we're going to be talking about one of the most popular musicals in recent years, a musical called Hairspray, based on a popular film of the same name from the late 80s. And the musical, I believe, was premiered sometime early in the 21st century, and it has been a big hit all over the place. A Tony Award winner for Best Musical in its first season on Broadway. It has been performed all over the country and currently is being performed at the Rohde Center for the Arts in downtown Kenosha. It opened last weekend and runs for two more weekends, and I'm excited to be able to speak with Katie Gray about this musical and about what people can expect if they make their way to the Rohde to enjoy Hairspray. Katie Gray, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thank you.
Tell us, first of all, what you know about the choice of Hairspray to be part of this current season of the Lakeside Players.
So we've wanted to put on Hairspray for a few years now, just because it's a very popular musical, like you said. It also just has a lot of appeal, and we were very lucky to secure the rights last year, and we decided it would be a great closer for our season.
Tell us, first of all, for anybody who has not seen it, kind of the genesis of this musical, which of course is that aforementioned film from the late 80s, if I remember correctly, and then tell us what you know about that film being transformed into this stage musical.
Yeah, so it was released in the late 80s, and it's about a teenage girl, Tracy Turnblad, who just wants to dance on the Courtney Collins show, which was a morning show in Baltimore in the early 1960s, and she didn't understand why she couldn't dance with all of her friends. So some of her friends were white, and they danced on the Courtney Collins show, and some of them were black, and they were only allowed to dance once a month on the show. And so it kind of goes over her wanting to kind of integrate the show. And then her dancing on the show was actually controversial because she is an overweight girl. And obviously they didn't have that, a lot of overweight people on TV in the 60s. And so the film is a cult classic. It's very funny. And then it was turned into a musical in, I think, 2003. And then in 2007, it was turned into a movie musical.
I think one of the things that is most intriguing about the show is that if anybody has heard any of the score, any of the songs, it's very high energy and very, very positive. And I think it often comes as a surprise to people that, in fact, there are some really serious issues that this musical also undertakes. Talk about that and the way that these issues that you just mentioned, how they are addressed in the show.
Yeah, so the one issue is, of course, like Tracy doesn't fit that typical, TV mold. She is overweight, and so it talks about how, like, she is, she's still optimistic that she can still get on because she has the talent, and so she doesn't really, see herself as kind of not fitting that mold. And then one of her friends that helps her get on the show, whose name is Seaweed, he is the son of the host of, they call it Negro Day, for the show. That is the African-American cast dancing on the Courtney Collins show. And it's and she doesn't understand, why she can't dance with them. And so, it kind of has explores the fat phobia. It also explores racism, especially in 1962 Baltimore, which is the South. I don't think a lot of people realize that. Certainly my cast, I don't think really understood that Baltimore is the South. And in 1962, it was absolutely the South. So, having an integrated dancing show was outrageous.
Hmm. So tell us how the show sort of unfolds. I mean, kind of the timeline from the time the curtain goes up to the time the curtain goes down. I mean, what is kind of the central plot line that we follow?
Yeah, so the main plot line is that one of the members of the Courtney Collins show has to leave the show for 9 months, and then they have open auditions. So Tracy decides to audition. She doesn't get in because she's auditioning in front of the producer, who is very, kind of a fat phobic racist producer, she kind of gets herself in front of Courtney Collins, who is the actual host of the program, using dance moves she learned by her friend Seaweed. And then, after she gets on, she's like, hey, we should all dance together, it doesn't matter. And it's sort of like that, they kind of explore that the whole second half of the show. How do we get the show to be integrated? It's not just about me being on a show that I want to be on. Now I want to do what's right, and I want to be able to have all of my friends dance together.
Hmm. I know probably some of our listeners have heard some of this score. For the sake of someone who's not heard it, how would you sum up or describe basically what this music sounds like?
It is extremely poppy for the most part. So it's definitely, like you said, it's an insanely upbeat show. The most popular song is probably the ending song with You Can't Stop the Beat. And it is just very poppy 60s dance style. They do have a little bit of rhythm and blues in a song called Welcome to the 60s. They also have some, really sweet songs. One that, they're about the girls growing up and trying to get out of their mother's shadows. And then the probably one of my favorite songs is the kind of love song between of Tracy's two parents. So yeah, but it's all very poppy. It's a very upbeat musical.
And I am assuming I'm assuming it has a ton of dancing. Describe the scope of the dancing and what kind of a challenge that presents for you.
It has an insane amount of dancing. It didn't present any challenge for me, but for the cast, obviously it did. They had to work just their butts off. You know, You Can't Stop the Beat, which is probably the most famous song, is the end song, which is also the most dance-heavy song. So after I ask them to dance for 2 hours, I'm like, but for the last 7 minutes, you have to dance your butts off. So after you're already extremely exhausted, I need you to dance just a little bit more. So, yeah, I mean, we had a very extensive dance audition. We had a choreographer who was amazing that came in and really worked with them and, you know, found everyone's kind of levels of dancing and was willing to work with them. And I think overall, I don't know how sometimes they do it for 2 hours and then come off stage and they're, you know, still standing. I don't think I would be.
Right. Tell us about casting the show and what kind of a challenge that was.
So casting was a very unique challenge because while it is inherently a very diverse cast to cast, we had to kind of figure out, like, our nicest kids had to look sort of like the certain 1960s TV way. You know, they all had to be, you know, thinner people that, you know, you would see on TV then. And then obviously we had to cast correctly for our Motormouth kids, which is the African-American cast. So while it was the most diverse cast that I've ever worked with, it was also the most challenging cast because we had to cast very specifically. So we were looking for that specificity. And then Tracy, we wanted it to be, you know, an actual girl who was a little heavier. And then the other one that is not a requirement per se is that the character of Tracy's mother, Edna, has typically been played by a man, you know, dressed as a woman. And so we wanted to kind of honor that. That's what, if people have seen the TV show, the movie, John Travolta was that in the movie.
Right.
So, 2007 movie. And so we wanted to honor that, too, because I just think that adds something to it.
Sure. So how big a cast are we talking about altogether?
29 people.
Wow. And it's not that big a stage.
Yeah.
So things get a little cozy, but I'm sure it's also the kind of show that just sort of sets the Rotary Center for the Arts on its ear with all of the energy. How did opening weekend go for you?
It went stellar. It was very good. All the audiences brought some great energy. You know, it's one of those rare things where I've been now laughing at the show for weeks. And so to get other people in that are laughing and clapping that aren't me, I think just the cast feeds off of that so well. So, we had some great audiences this weekend.
Well, you have two more weekends to go, and if people are interested in getting tickets for Hairspray, what do they do?
They can, our box office is open an hour before each show. Otherwise, they can go to roadiecenter.org and get tickets that way.
Very good. Katie Gray, stage director for Hairspray. Best wishes to your cast and your crew for your last two weekends of Hairspray.
Thank you so much.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, Aldo Cazzolini and his fascinating book called The Never-Ending Empire, a look at the lasting influence of the Roman Empire. From the WGTD Arts and Other Events calendar, a special Mother's Day brunch is being hosted this Sunday at 10 a.m. by the Tremper High School Golden Strings. And there are tickets that are still available for this very special event. Contact Tremper High School for more information. Our weather forecast calls for sunny skies today, but a little cooler than it's been, with a high of 58 degrees and cooler readings near the lake. Clear and downright cold overnight. In fact, a widespread frost is expected through much of the listening area. We'll have a low tonight of 36 degrees. Tomorrow, Friday, sunny with a high of 66, On Saturday and Sunday, we warm under sunny skies to 76 degrees. In fact, by the middle of next week, we expect a daytime high of 80. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.